We continue our series of studies on the Catechism. Remember that we have been trying to update the Catechism so that it is more suited to our needs. So we come now to study number 13, the preservation of the family. We are actually dealing with the Ten Commandments at the moment. The Ten Commandments was thought to be originally written on two tables of stones. The first four commandments were on the first table of stone given to Moses. Then the next six were supposed to be written on the second table of stones. The traditional classification would be that the first four commandments have to do with our relationship with God, and the last six have to do with our relationship with man. But remember that we are not to separate the last six from the first four, because the Lord Jesus Christ summarizes the commandments of God into two, namely to love our God with all our heart, all our soul, all our mind, and all our strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. One follows from the other. And we must therefore not treat our relationship with man as though it's a separate matter, unconnected with our relationship with God. A better way would be to look upon the last six commandments as our service to God. So in the first four, we worship God. In the last six, we serve God. So in that way, everything is God-centered and depends on our relationship to Him. So now that we have covered the first four commandments, we are coming to the last six. If we were to cover the last six in one sitting, we would have to summarize very greatly and miss out on the richness of God's Word. And therefore, I've decided to break these commandments into two sections. Tonight we are going to consider the commandment number 5, 6 and 7. Then the next study will cover the remainder of the three commandments. Now, one way of looking at these three commandments we are covering tonight is to see how they relate to the family, then the next three commandments, how they relate to society. Okay? So let us look at the questions and answers. Which is the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment is honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. What is required in the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment requires the preserving the honor and performing the duties belonging to everyone in their various positions and relationships as superiors, inferiors, or equals. Now, what is the reason annexed to the fifth commandment? The reason annexed to the fifth commandment is a promise of long life and prosperity, as far as it shall serve for God's glory and their own good, to all such as keep His commandment. So we come to the commands. Comment number one, the fifth, sixth and seventh commandments may be considered as those commandments that guard the institution of the family, which is the basic unit of the church and the state. Now, I might add that these are the three institutions of God for men on this earth: the family, the church, and the state. So individuals are created in such a way that we are meant to be in a family in the church, and the church, the state. Now, it is our duty to respect and obey all legitimate authorities, since they are God-given. In the family, parents have authority over the children, and the husband is the head of the family. In the church, elders are appointed to rule over God's people for their good. In the state, there may be a king or queen or government of some kind. The Bible has much to say about the believing family and the church. While giving sufficient principles to guide believers in their behavior in the world, no particular form of state government is favored, except that which conforms closely to the principles revealed in the Bible. So by forms of state governments, I'm referring to whether it is a free democracy, like what the world seems to be fighting for and clamoring as the best form of government. Or it can be totalitarian, either in a religious sense or in a human sense. So in a religious sense, we would find many Arabic countries have such totalitarian governments where the religious authority control the state. The people have no say, as in contrast to democracy, where the people have all the say. Okay? Or it can be a human form of totalitarianism, like communism. So in a truly communist country, the ruling party, often led by one man, they rule the country with an iron hand. Traditionally, we have Russia and China, but Russia, the communism there has fallen, and China is namely a communist country, but it's loosening up, and they seem to be quite benevolent, although still having a lot of control. Perhaps the type of totalitarianism that we are talking about may be seen in Myanmar currently. There are human rule that is very rigid without any say from the citizen. Okay? Or it can be a republic where there's no king, or a monarchy where there is a king. Or it can be a mixture in between. So in this country, for example, it is supposed to be a constitutional monarchy. So the constitution rules. The monarch is a figurehead, although having some roles to play in the check and balance system. So it's a constitutional monarchy. Whereas in some countries, it is a monarchy ruled by the people, ruled by a king or a queen. Or it may be a republican type of government where there's no king, it's totally ruled by the people, by the choice of the people. Okay? Now it can be socialism, which is like communism, except that in communism they control the sharing of the wealth with no right of private property, whereas in socialism there is a desire to share, but there is the acknowledgement that we have private right of property, the right to private property. Okay, so these are the main forms of church government we encounter in the world. Now, the Bible does not seem to favor any particular form of government. If we are born into a situation where that government exists, we try to fit in as best as we can. And we would approve of any government that attempts to implement principles of justice, mercy, fairness, rewarding the good, punishing the wrong, maintaining peace, promoting the well-being of the people, and so on. Those are what we regard as biblical principles. So what is the point of having the government that you prefer or you believe in, but it is not promoting biblical principles like this? And what is there to complain if a so-called communist government is actually trying to implement these principles of the Bible? So the name is not what finally matters. What finally matters is whether there is an attempt to carry out this, the ruling of the people, with principles that come close to the Bible, like this. Okay? So we take note that this commandment teaches us principles that affect not only the family, but it affects our interaction with one another in society. It affects the other two institutions, the church and the state. Okay? So there is this lawful authority given by God in each of these institutions. Now back to the family, because it's so basic to society. Parents have to teach children obedience to lawful authorities in an atmosphere of love and allowing for growth and development in them. Sternness and excessive control cause frustration in the children, provoking them to anger and discouraging them. Colossians chapter 3, verse 20 tells us this. Colossians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians chapter 3. We are told in verse 20 of Colossians chapter 3, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. And a similar passage, a parallel passage, is Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, we are told, and you, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. The biblical teaching is so clear, to the point that we assume every Christian should know this. But strangely enough, we are controlled more by culture than by the Bible. Often it is that we look upon the mothers as the ones who have the authority to raise up the children, and especially in their discipline. And the fathers are not at home and therefore not involved or not concerned. And that is not right. And then furthermore, we are told, do not provoke your children to wrath. We keep thinking of discipline, see, as over against love. So the two things tend to be pitted against one another. You either love too much, or you discipline too much, or love in the wrong way, or you discipline in the wrong way. Hey, wait a moment. The Bible's teaching is, you love them, yes, therefore you love them in the right way, in a biblical way. You discipline them in a biblical way. But note that here there is such a thing as provoking your children to wrath. Which one of us is guilty of this? Have we along the way been provoking our children, being unreasonable? And here we can only summarize. We want to raise up our children in the atmosphere of love, allowing for there to be growth in them, not growth just physically, but growth in their mental capacity, growth in their ability to be responsible, and there is development in them. Sternness and excessive control causes frustration in the children, provoking them to anger and discouraging them. This is where the fault lies. A lot of parents do not realize this. That is why in the teaching in church, we constantly have to point this out and remind parents, just as we remind them of the need to love them in the right way by properly disciplining them. Now, failure to exercise proper discipline results in self-will and rebellion in the children that manifest in later life, either in their own family when the day arrives for them to have their own family, or in the family in which he's growing up, even before his marriage, it shows. Then parents will have a tough time. Imagine a teenager who is too rebellious, and now it is too late to bend his character, to mold him anymore. See, it causes such heartaches to the parents. And when he's married, you discover he's a monster at home. The wife may have to suffer in silence until one day everything breaks out into the open because the wife can't stand it anymore, or some tragedy occurs in the family. Right? So we don't want that to happen. But it begins from the time when your children are young. So you don't train them to understand that there is such a thing as proper lawful authority that we must submit to, and train them in a proper way without provoking them, then they are going to be a problem. And similarly in society, if they are a problem in society, you are going to face the difficulties as well of having a son or a daughter who is rebellious and getting himself or herself into problems with the law. We just got news of a family who had a very rebellious son. See? And the son now is in another country. And what happened is that he got into trouble with the authorities. The police stopped him for speeding, and he fought with the police. And now he's going to have big trouble. And the family, of course, is very upset and very anxious, don't know what to do, what can be done. You see, it's terrible, you see. There are those whom we respect as our superiors, others as our inferiors, and yet others as our equals, depending on the position and relationship between us and these people. So that is the teaching of the Bible. This commandment actually shows to us that in life we sustain a certain relationship to either people who are above us by virtue of their position or by virtue of that relationship that sustains between us. For example, if he's our father or mother, straight away he or she is our superior in that relationship. Or if it is at the place of work, or if it is at the place of study, a student straight away has his teachers as his superiors. Then there are those who are our inferiors, they are below us. If we have workers, then your workers are your inferiors. How do you deal with them? How do you treat them? Then there are your equals in the place of work, your colleagues. In the school, there are the students. In the family, there are your brothers and sisters. Okay. Now, how we obey this commandment is reflected in our attitude, our speech, and our actions. How good it is if the respect is accompanied with love instead of terror. Comment number 3. Long life and prosperity is promised to God's people corporately. That means considered as a group. Although this truth applies generally to the individual as well. When God's people are careless or indifferent to what is taught in this commandment, the three institutions of family, church, and society become weakened so that anarchy and violence prevail. Anarchy means with no rule of law. People do as they like. So anarchy and violence prevail. Then the blessing of peace and opportunity to serve God is removed, and lives may be lost. Remember that the Bible's teaching is that we should prefer peace to war, to civil war or to outright war of nation fighting nation. 1 Timothy chapter 2 verse 1 tells us, therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. We are peace-loving people. We prefer peace to war. Sometimes war cannot be avoided. Sometimes there is chaos in a nation. We have to live in a nation that is full of violence. But our preference is peace. But not peace just for its own sake, but peace in order to serve our God well and to preach the gospel. However, Christians will have to resist abuse of authority, whether in the family, the church, or the state. So sometimes in a family, things are unbearable. For example, we have a husband who physically abuses the wife, pulling her hair, using his knee to knee the face, banging the wife's head against the wall. Now what do children do? The time comes when the children have to take the father aside, push him away, if necessary, whack him so that he is not unconscious, otherwise the mother will be killed. Now we must see that that is allowed. In fact, we have a duty to do so. Abuse of power in the family. And similarly in the church, if the leadership of the church disobeys the Bible and does not carry out what is required or do things that are forbidden and continues on despite being pointed out, then it is right to do something to stop that. See? Depending on the sort of wrongs done, see? We might have to approach other elders of the church and protest. We might have to have the item discussed as one of the agenda of the church meeting. And if things do not work, we might have to just call for a referendum for the whichever leader is in control to be removed. We really have to do something in such a situation. And in the worst case, when everything has been done and nothing can be done about changing the situation, we might have to leave and perhaps even publicize the wrong. Then there is the state. If the state abuses power, it is not a case of a minor infringement here and there due to sin in man, but there is a case of consistent, persistent abuse of power. There might come a time when we have to resist the authorities. Resistance is legitimate when the authority is transgressing the biblical limits and whenever there is direct contradiction against the Bible's teaching. So we look at it overall and we look at each of the action of the government. If overall is transgressing the limit of the Bible, we might have to forcibly overthrow the government. Some Christians don't like to hear that. They are pacifists. They don't like revolution. They say civil disobedience is wrong under all circumstances. We say under such a situation where the authority is not doing its work as God requires, it is abusing its power. Instead of rewarding the good and punishing the bad, the authority is promoting what is bad and punishing the good. See? Then the time comes when as citizens we have to rise up and forcibly overthrow the government. Yeah? And we consider next certain actions. If that particular action is a direct contradiction of the Bible's teaching, on that point we don't have to obey. We are still submitted to the government, but on that particular point we don't have to obey. Just like the apostles, when they were commanded not to preach in the name of Jesus anymore, they said we must obey God rather than man. Okay? So that covers the fifth commandment. We come to the sixth commandment. Which is the sixth commandment? The sixth commandment is, you shall not murder. What is required in the sixth commandment? The sixth commandment requires all lawful endeavors to preserve our own life and the life of others, while forbidding whatever that tends towards taking away human life unjustly. Notes. Under the notes, we have these words. Spurgeon kept the negative questions for the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 10th commandments. Remember in the original catechism, there is a question asking, which is this commandment? then what is required of this commandment and what is forbidden of this commandment. So for the 6th, 7th, 8th and 10th commandments, Spurgeon chose to keep the negative answers, the negative questions and answers, what is forbidden. Except for question 9, he keeps the positive one, what is required. We shall keep all the positive questions to all the commandments and combine the positive and negative answers wherever necessary. And in this particular commandment, for the 6th commandment, we have added the word human to the answer of this question, taking away human life unjustly. Although we do not expect Christians to quibble over this, but we never know. Some people may not be well taught and along the way been influenced by humanistic ideas and animal lovers, and they say animals have life as well. So what you do to human life, what you believe about human life, should be extended to animals. So you should never ever kill animals under all circumstances. Okay. But here we know that animal life is different from human life, and the commandment covers human life. We come to the comments. Our lives come from God through our parents. Since man is made in God's image, life is sacred. Let us look at the Bible passages. Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. In the account of creation, we have in verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then look at chapter 9, Genesis chapter 9. After the flood, there is a new beginning. So in Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, we are told, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. So you cannot simply take a person's life. God looks upon it as serious because life is precious in his sight. Man is made in the image of God. So there is such a thing as the sanctity of life. Life is sacred. An animal has life as well, but it is not created like man. Look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 30. We are told, also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, are given every green herb for food. And it was so. So the Bible acknowledges that there are living creatures, they have life, but their life is of a different character from the life of humans. Only human beings are special in God's sight. They are created in the image of God. The unjust killing of a human being is murder. The killing of another person may not be murder, as when our lives are threatened in a robbery. Someone comes into your house, break open, and comes in. He has a weapon. He intends to rob your house. He is discovered, and now he threatens you. He comes forward and wants to slash you with a machete. What do you do? Well, in the process, you pick up a stick somewhere and then you whack at the person. And while whacking the person, you hit him on the head. And perhaps he has fainted. But as you examine him, to your horror, you discover he's dead. See? Now that is not regarded as murder. See? If you are brought to the law courts, a proper court of law will rule that as homicide. It is not murder. It's accidental killing. And of course, that you might be punished for taking a life. But in a situation where the person uses a weapon, in as far as I know, you will not be punished, because your life is truly threatened. But if the person is without a weapon and you have a weapon to defend yourself, you might be punished, but not as one who has murdered. You would be punished more because you have used excessive force more than necessary. And that is very difficult to determine. And this is where the judge has to weigh up the circumstances. See? So for example, the person comes unarmed and you take out your gun, your pistol, and you fire at the person, perhaps even without warning. So the heavier penalty would be upon you. But even so, you are not treated as a murderer because the person was an intruder with a possibility of him causing harm to you or your family. Okay? So not all cases of taking a person's life is murder. A Christian who serves in the army may be required to kill in defense of the country or in a just cause. We have to add that because sometimes the army is sent elsewhere, for example, for peacekeeping or to help in a disaster. And let us say they help in a natural disaster somewhere and there's looting and then some of the people begin to use weapons to whack the soldiers. Now what do they have the soldiers to do? They have to shoot some of them perhaps, you see. So in such a case, it is not wrong. In this situation, the Christian is not acting in his private capacity, but as a proper agent of the government. Capital punishment, that is the killing of those who commit murder, is the duty of the government, not of the individual. The government actually has the right to execute, to take the life of someone who has murdered other people. Okay? In fact, it might be a duty to do so. If the government hedges on that, one who has clearly murdered, see, if the government does not take firm action to execute that person and spare him on some false principles of mercy, the government is not only breaking God's law, it may be doing more harm by allowing that person to be around to kill another person, okay, as often happens. Okay. But of course there is the grey area. To what extent or to what degree do you regard the action of the person as constituting murder? How direct has it to be? Is drug pushing murder? You can argue that it is, because if you consume too much of any type of drug, then you destroy life in the long run. But destroying life in the long run, is that murder with the time stretched out and with the person taking the drug having some measure of control where he decides whether to take or not? See? So is that murder? So does drug trafficking warrant capital punishment? And that is where it's questionable. Okay? So our purpose is not to discuss all this grey area, but we want to point out the principle that when a murder has taken place, when somebody deliberately takes the life of another, that person deserves death. He might be pardoned, we don't know. See, under unusual circumstances, he might be pardoned. Perhaps he was mentally unsound, perhaps there was really severe provocation of some kind in his family, and it was a case of mistaken identity or whatever. All this might come into play and may be way out, and such a person might be pardoned. We do not know. Each case has to be determined on its own merit. But the principle is that when we deliberately take the life of another, we are deserving of death. And the government only has the right to carry out that capital punishment. It is not for individuals or any other group of individuals that has not been given the mandate by God to carry out such execution. You cannot start a vigilante sort of situation where Batman or Robin Hood goes killing others because the authorities are not doing its job. No, we have no right to. Okay? And especially revenge by the family members, we have no right to do so. Yes. Now, the next comment is, suicide is a breaking of this commandment. In Job 1 verse 20, when Job's family members died, he acknowledges that God is the one who gives and God is the one who takes away. And that principle applies to our own life. God gave us life, God has the right to take away our life. It is not for us to take our own life. And this point really has to be emphasized nowadays, to be taught very clearly to our people. In later days, when you are faced with severe pressure of any kind, and you become desperate, you're so ashamed, or you're so in such a terrible burden of pressure, you thought that the best way of avoiding all this is to take your own life. Then remember this teaching. No true Christian will think of taking his own life. It is a terrible sin. We must not contemplate taking our own life. God alone has the right to take our life. Whatever the pressure may be, we commit it to the Lord. The Lord will not put us under more pressure than we can bear. Along the way, He will allow a way of escape. He will not tempt us to commit suicide. No, there's always a way of escape. There is always a way in which He will deliver us. If we have been wrong, confess it, put things right. Be prepared to take whatever punishment that you deserve. But there's no need for you to take your own life. And often this type of situation arises more because of what we think others are thinking of us. We lose face, we are ashamed, and so on. But actually, what has others' opinion of you to do with your own life? Just because of what you think they are thinking of you, you feel so terrible to the extent that you want to take away your life. That's not right. It is what God thinks of you that is more important. Okay? And because of the lack of teaching in this area, people imitate. They read of this, they hear of this. You see how many actresses and actors have committed suicide. And then you hear of students under pressure of exams and the demands of the parents to have good results, they have committed suicide. See? Boy-girl relationship that didn't turn out well, they commit suicide. You see, there seems to be a certain glory attached to committing suicide. It's wrong. We shouldn't be thinking of that. And deliberately placing ourselves or others in danger of life is also breaking this commandment. Example, engaging in life-threatening sports, engaging in daredevil stunts, etc. Traditionally, Christians wouldn't approve of bullfighting because the person is just courting danger to his own life. And people take pleasure in that. Oh, such a hero. And others find bullfighting revulsive, but for the wrong reason. In the end, the bull is killed. So they love the bull more than the man. But for us, it is this principle that life is sacred. We must not endanger our own life. And for the same reason, I believe, many of the modern sports in which people place themselves in unnecessary danger just for the thrill of it and just to show off to others, to create thrills in others, I believe Christians shouldn't be encouraging those sports and not even encouraging, let alone participating ourselves. You want some examples? You know, some of those shows, aeroplane shows, where they fly here and fly there demonstrating the capability of the aeroplane and the pilot, you see. Those aeronautical display and then the expo and then they do that sort of thing. You see, it's not right. The government shouldn't be encouraging that sort of thing, you see. Then also those extreme sports where you ride a motorbike up the ramp and then land further on, and some go to the extent of performing acrobatics in the air and turn and then before they land. And these are often not even professionals. They are people who train and then go in competition to show off. This should not be encouraged, and Christians shouldn't put themselves in unnecessary danger like that. Now, of course, there you can argue it out, you can debate and say that we must stretch ourselves to the limit of the ability God has given to us in accomplishing things that are good, yes, but not in endangering your life. So this is where grey areas come in again, but you must be quite clear of the main principle that you don't unnecessarily place yourself or others in danger. And failure to remove a potentially life-threatening situation is also breaking this commandment. For example, allowing children to play with knives. It is required that we seek our neighbor's good. Example, warning him of dangers. Let us say you have a blind neighbor who is walking near to the cliff. Now you have to go and stop him and warn him and say, hey, you're heading the wrong direction. Turn around, because that is the cliff. You have a duty to do so. Otherwise, when he dies, you are breaking this commandment. And similarly, in normal life, let us say, for some reason, there is a major pothole that developed in front of your neighbor's house. And you know that he's going to drive home tonight on his motorbike in the dark. You know? Now, he might get terribly injured and might even lose his life. Now, you know about it. You should go and warn him in advance. Call him on the phone, or perhaps stick a flag in that hole and call the authorities to quickly come and deal with that hole. So we do have a duty to warn others of dangers to their life. Now the highest good we can do to others is to warn them of Judgment Day, and therefore the need to proclaim the gospel to them. So James chapter 5 verse 20 tells us this truth. We are told in James 5:20, he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. Now we move on to the next question. Which is the seventh commandment? The seventh commandment is, you shall not commit adultery. Which is required? What is required in the seventh commandment? The seventh commandment requires the preservation of chaste thoughts, words, and actions in ourselves and others. I should perhaps have added some the notes there, that the wordings are quite different from the original, but the content is not. The wording actually comes from the negative answer, what is forbidden. So I'm taking that to put in here and putting it in a positive way. Yeah? The seventh commandment requires the preservation of chaste thoughts, words, and actions in ourselves and others. The commands. Sexual desire was included in the creation of Adam and Eve, and therefore to be regarded as very good. And again, this would come as a shock to a lot of people who have not been taught in this area, because we grow up in a culture where sex is taboo, you don't talk about it, and generally it is regarded as dirty, just like politics is dirty in the public sphere. In the private sphere, sex is dirty. So we got this idea. So it's as though no Christian should ever be in politics. Now, in a sense, it's true. We know very well that where the power is involved, people are tempted, sinful people are tempted to abuse power. So politics, to a great extent, is dirty. But it doesn't mean that you paint it with a brush totally like that, and then no Christian should be in politics. Some Christians are gifted to be in politics, and that may be their vocation, that may be their life calling, to serve God as a Christian politician, like Daniel and like Joseph in the Bible. See? And in the private life, people have the wrong idea, sex is dirty. But what does the Bible say? in Genesis chapter 2, when Adam and Eve was created, they were created as sexual individuals. We read Genesis chapter 2, starting from verse 23. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." And look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. After the creation of everything, verse 31, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning was the sixth day." So after the creation of man, male and female, so if man was created, male and female, and God's creation was very good, it must include their sexuality as well. Okay? So sexuality is not something dirty, is very good. It's created by God for a good purpose. And as we study more, it becomes clear that God intends it for the good of man by them getting married and procreate and have children. And sex is actually something to be enjoyed in a marriage relationship. It is God's gift to the married couple, and it is such a source of a comfort to them. Now, it is this need which draws people together in marriage. The Bible condemns the unlawful satisfaction of the sexual urge outside the institution of marriage, which is fornication. So fornication may be regarded as a general word covering illicit sex of all kinds, including rape, premarital sex, adultery, bestiality, that is sex with animals, and homosexuality, that is sex between the same kind of the same gender. Okay, so we don't want to classify into lesbianism as between females and so on, but we know generally speaking homosexuality means homo, sex of the same, homo, same sex relationship. Okay, so the Bible condemns fornication, any sexual relationship outside marriage. Now, we straight away realize that this is one area, one matter that is so much abuse everywhere. See, and as the ages go by, we seem to go worse and worse in this area. And we remember Sodom and Gomorrah, when civilization declined, this is the area where it is most obvious that society just degrades to that extent, where people just do as they like in expressing their sexuality. And we learn from history that when Rome declined, that was what happened as well. And in today's society, we see that this is again happening. It's rampant, the abuse of sex. Okay? And we have to say that in us, the sexual urge inclines us in the right direction of sinning against God. And because we have a sinful nature, that sinful nature is stirred up to want to make us sin against God, just like others around us. And if not for the grace of God operating in us, we would be in a similar situation as they, having sexual relationship in an unrestrained manner, breaking God's law. And therefore, while we acknowledge that this is a widely abused gift from God, we nevertheless acknowledge that we would have been one of them if not for the grace of God operating in us. We want to point out the fact, but we dare not condemn, because when we condemned, more fingers point back at our direction. So we want to be conscious of that fact, that God has been gracious to us. And God has graciously provided ways for us to handle the sexual urge by a number of ways. Firstly, by the gift of continency. Continency basically means self-control. In Matthew chapter 19, verse 12, the Lord tells us of certain individuals who give up marriage not because they are not sexual, not because they don't have the sexual urge, but they are able to control that sexual urge. And therefore, they prefer to serve God more freely without the burden of family responsibilities. So that's why they forego marriage. Then, marriage itself is given in order that the sexual urge may be legitimately fulfilled. And then thirdly, by giving us holy desires and opportunities of spiritual pursuits. Of course, this applies to married people as well, but we are here referring to those who want to get married, but for various reasons are not yet married. How has God graciously provided ways of preventing us from sinning against Him in this area? By giving us holy desires, such that we pursue holy things instead of allowing our mind to dwell on sex and perverted thinking, and along the way get tempted. Instead, we pursue holy thoughts and holy actions. And if you turn with me to 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, which is a very helpful verse which all young people should bear in mind. We are told in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, "Flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart." A few things can be said. Firstly, you note we are told to flee also youthful lusts. Youthful lusts includes other lusts as well. Love of power, love to show off in the world, love to be one above other people, and so on. See, if others have a BlackBerry phone, we also want one. He has the latest computer, we also want one. He drives the latest car, we also want. There are many youthful lusts. Gambling, having the easy way out to make money, and so on. But we know that youthful lusts, although covering other lusts, it includes also sexual desires that is channeled in the wrong direction. And we must flee. We must get away from any situation in which we are stirred up to dwell on this area of our needs. It is a need, but we don't dwell on it. We flee from anything that stirs up this area. In the old days, we would say, don't read pornographic literature. Don't go to the bookshop on the way back and go straight to the magazine section and look at Playboy magazine. You know the name Playboy straight away is pornography. Don't go near there. See? And today we will say, be careful of your computer when nobody's around. You talk to friends, especially those who are in this area. Then you talk about it, and then you exchange URLs, and you, along the way, go and watch pornographic sites. It's not going to be helpful to you. Perhaps as I'm speaking, somebody's conscience is being stirred here, you see. Let God speak to you and let yourself respond rather than resist the work of the Spirit in you. Learn that God is trying to say to you, stop, because it is not helpful to you. Okay? And another thing that can be said is that you don't play a defensive game all the time. You see? You don't keep fleeing and fleeing, but you must pursue. Now you must actively pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace. So pursue spiritual things that build you up spiritually. And finally, one more thing that must be said is, don't do it on your own, alone. Because it says, pursue all this together with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. The company you keep makes a lot of difference to your life. If you keep good company, they will build you up. They will be an encouragement to you. They will help you. You will have greater motivation to do what is right and pleasing in God's sight. You do it alone, you discover soon you lose a steam. The motivation is lost. And when you fall, there's nobody around to help you. See? Then we take note that Christians may marry only in the Lord. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39. And we are not to be unequally yoked. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 verse 14. If a person is married before becoming a Christian, he has a duty to keep that marriage as long as the unbelieving partner is willing to remain in that marriage. So when a couple is married already, one of them hears the gospel and is convinced and convicted, and he's going to turn to Christ, and finally he turns to Christ in faith. Okay? Of course, since there is true faith in his or her heart, there will be the desire to follow the Lord at all costs, even at the cost of being broken up in the marriage relationship. See, that is the price we have to pay. But thankfully, if we handle things well, the unbelieving spouse along the way has been informed and know that you are going to church and that you are interested in the Christian faith, and along the way, when you finally come to faith, you break the news to him or to her, he or she is not unduly upset. Okay? And the marriage relationship continues. But if the husband is adamant and violent and decides to break the marriage, we try to persuade him, we can send people to talk to him, and so on. Relatives can go, the church people can go for you and talk to the person, persuade him, help him to see that you are changed for the better than for the worse, and even persuade him to come to consider the Christian faith, and hopefully everything will work out well. Okay? But what if he insists and all attempts made to keep the marriage has failed? You have no choice. You have to let the person go. Okay? And things will have to be done legally. Then when you are legally divorced, you may remarry. You are not sinning in that case. Okay? You want to keep the marriage, but the unbelieving partner refuses. So you are not at fault there. And since the marriage relationship is broken, it is as though your spouse have died. Normally, you have to wait till your spouse die before that marriage covenant is broken. But in this case, it's broken. Totally broken. Because he refuses to live with you. So it's broken. Okay? Then you can remarry. And if there is a breaking up of the marriage covenant by physical abuse, like the example I was giving of a husband who bashes his wife physically, or desertion that cannot be remedied, see, then the person may remarry. Some churches say no remarriage under all circumstances. We say, you mean well, your church mean well to teach that, but it is wrong teaching. We don't believe in that. We believe the marriage is sacred and must be for life, with every intention of being, and every effort is made to keep it for life. But when there is a case of a marriage being abused like that, where one party shows himself to be a non-believer, he abuses the wife terribly, or it can be the other way around. I've known of cases where the wife abuses the husband physically. You know, the wife is such a powerful woman, and the husband was so fearful of the wife, abused by the husband. So until it doesn't work anymore, each sleep in a different room, and tension in the family, and every time coming home, there's bashing, fighting, and the weaker one, of course, suffers. Or there's desertion. One party just goes away, seldom return, and ignores the person, and doesn't provide for the person, and just disappear. You see? So, in such situations, when the time comes, you have to break the marriage. And then the victim, the one who is wronged, may remarry, because the marriage covenant has been broken by the other party. Okay. Marriage to close relatives by consanguinity or by affinity is also forbidden. Consanguinity means closeness by marriage. That means you cannot marry your wife's sister. It's your sister-in-law. Even after your wife died, you shouldn't marry your sister-in-law. Okay? Because you are close by marriage. Then by affinity, that is by blood, you shouldn't marry somebody who is too closely related to you by blood. For example, you can marry, the closest you can go is the cousin. See? but you can't marry your brother and sister, and an uncle cannot marry a niece, although some cultures allowed it, but according to the Bible, you are not allowed to. A grandfather cannot marry the granddaughter, it's not allowed. See? So many laws in the many countries of the world, they have this written down. See? And of course, underage children cannot marry it. They generally have to seek special consent, especially under 18. And of course, those who are not mature, is against any correct thinking person to marry a person below 12 years old, even below 15. Okay? But most countries recognize age 18 onwards as the age where the person can give consent and desire to get married. But anyone younger than that has to need special person permission. For example, you barely reach age 18, you are 16 years old, you want to get married, then you have to seek special permission both from the family and by law. In our country, the chief minister of the state has to issue you a certificate, a license to allow you to marry in such a situation. Okay? Now, all in all, we must guard our hearts to prevent sinning inwardly and by actions. Don't treat the action itself as sin. In the heart itself, we may be sinning. When you look at a woman and lust after her, you are already sinning. See? And often it is a sin in the heart that would finally manifest itself in action. But for the Christian, we don't just treat the action itself as bad. It is the heart itself that is bad. Okay? The sin in the heart, it is already sin. Now we sin inwardly and by our actions. And therefore, this is we need to come back to 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22. Easy for our young people to remember and for all of us to remember that we must flee youthful lusts. And remember, youthful lusts are still in older people. So you must be careful. Flee youthful lusts and pursue things that are righteous and good and pure, together with those of the same mind, in the church, together with other people. Be regular in church, take part in church activities, and serve the Lord together. So worship and serve the Lord together with your brothers and sisters in Christ. God has provided this avenue, this way of controlling your sexual urge. Your sexual urge in itself is not wrong. You are normal. Don't feel guilty that you are struggling with your sexual urge. Don't feel guilty at all. See? Because it is given to you by God. It is how you control it, whether you abuse it or you control it well. So as believers, the Bible teaches us that God has given us His Spirit and given us therefore holy desires, and He has given us the church where we worship God together, we serve God together, and by the help of His Spirit, in the company of His people, God will see you through. You can live a godly life, whether you are young or whether you are old, until such time as you fulfill your desire of getting married. Okay? So with that, we come to the end of tonight's study. Are there questions or comments?